Angie. I've heard her CD. She's got a powerful message. I'm so excited to be able to open this microphone to Angie. Thank you all.
Hello, family. My name is Angie, and I'm an addict. I'd like to, of course, thank the NACONA committee for asking me to share. From what I understand, I have some really big shoes to fill because I wasn't their first choice, and that's okay. Tommy let me know the list of people who were originally supposed to be up here, and I was like, holy cow, and a little intimidated by that fact. But you know what? As much as the disease of addiction likes to tell me that I'm inadequate and I have no business standing up in front of you guys, my recovery tells me that I'm an addict and you're an addict. And my recovery reminds me that someone out there needs to hear the story that I have to share. And so if you're that person or if you are those people, I love you and you're not alone. I'd like to ask our two newcomers to please stand back up for a moment. Now I'm going to give you an assignment, you two. While you're here this weekend, I challenge you to get at least 5 phone numbers of people you don't know. And then you have to use those phone numbers after this weekend. Because here's the deal. If we were in active addiction and I handed you a stranger's phone number and I told you to call that person because they have the good shit, you wouldn't hesitate to call them. So I'm telling you that these people in this room, they have the good shit and you need it. So call them. We're so glad you're here. And if you guys catch me tonight or throughout this weekend, I do have something for you. Because I kept seeing you going, is that it? Is that all you got for me? I actually have something for the both of you in my room. All right? Hey, hey, hey. I'm a married woman. My husband's right there. Narcotics Anonymous has taught me how to be a loyal wife today. So I can invite you up to my room, and it's going to be all good. Actually, I'll bring it down. because I respect my husband that much, too. All right, so let's get on to this. NACONA 1. One disease, the disease of addiction. One program, Narcotics Anonymous. One promise, is that an addict, any addict, can stop using drugs, lose the desire to use, and find a new way of life. I talk a lot about God when I share, but Narcotics Anonymous is not a religious program, it's a spiritual program. We hear that in our readings, right? And our basic text tells us we were in the grip of a hopeless dilemma, the solution of which is spiritual in nature. And I know because I have the majority of my literature also on PDF form, so I can access it through my phone, and I get to look up words and see how many times they're referenced in our literature. And I can tell you in the basic text, God is referenced over 300 times from the beginning to the end. So I say God. I don't often say higher power. If you don't have a God, that's okay. Welcome. If you don't believe in God, that's okay. Welcome. If you are mad at God, that's okay. Welcome. Because I know that the God of my understanding sent me to this group of drug addicts to get some good orderly direction. Right? And so you get to choose your own God in Narcotics Anonymous. We only have 3 suggestions for you. That he be loving, that he be that he be loving and that he be more powerful than you, right? Loving, caring, and more powerful than you. Thank you very much. Look, we don't do this alone. We don't do this alone. I love my fellowship. So I was introduced to the program of Narcotics Anonymous when I was 16 years old in 1986. And no, I do not have that much clean time. The reason I had to be introduced to the program in 1986 when I was 16 years old, because by that time I had already been sexually abused. I had already found out what it was like to be abandoned by my father, by my stepfather. And when my brothers came home with a bag of weed when I was 8 years old and started getting me loaded, I liked the way it made me feel. And I remember this one time my brother said to me, I'm going to go get a dime bag, and I pulled a dime out of my pocket and I told him to get me one too. I mean, I didn't know, right? I just knew that what was in that bag was going to make me feel differently than the way I was feeling, and I already wanted my own at 8 years old. By the time I was 16, I was a gold medal runaway. I was jumping from him to him to him. If you were going to cheat on me, if you were going to lie to me, I understood what that kind of love felt like. If you were going to respect me and be kind to me, I was going to walk all over you. I was in and out of juvenile hall. I like to say I spent more time in juvenile hall than I did in high school. And at 16, I ran away from home for the last time, and I knew that it was pull out the crocodile tears or go to juvenile prison in Adobe Mountain until I was 18 years old. So as I was sat in juvenile hall, I called my probation officer, Penny Nickel. And we'll never forget that woman's name, Penny Nickel. Right? Crocodile tears, I think, is really the one and only time that I pulled up the fake tears, because I've never really been good at that. And I told her, I have a drug problem, I'm addicted to marijuana, and I need help. And of course, I wasn't going to admit all the other stuff that I was doing, right? Because it was a lot. But it worked, and I got to go to this treatment center, and I was just, you know, I wasn't going to treatment to stop using drugs. I was going to treatment to get my mom off my back, to get the courts off my back, so that I could go back out and do the same stuff that I was doing, right? Because it was the only way that I knew how to deal with the way that I was feeling. So I went into treatment and I went in loaded. And newcomers, we've got a couple of good news and bad news situations for you guys. Good news is you're going to get your feelings back. Bad news is you're going to get your feelings back. And a couple of weeks into the treatment program, my feelings started coming back. And I started getting scared. Because when I left treatment, I was coming back to Yuma, Arizona from Sandy. I was coming back to Yuma, Arizona, and I didn't know anybody that didn't get loaded. My treatment facility, they all lived in San Diego. Anybody here from treatment? No? Yeah? You go to treatment from out to a different town than the one that you lived in? Yeah. No? Yeah? Some of you are like, yeah. It's scary having to go back to where you live, right? Because you don't know anybody that doesn't get loaded, and that was the situation that I was in. And so a couple of weeks into this treatment facility, I started thinking maybe I should start listening to what these people have to say, right? And the things that they had to say is they were talking about Narcotics Anonymous, and they were talking about reading the basic text. And they were talking about getting a sponsor and working steps and going to meetings and being of service and finding a God of your understanding that you can do business with, right? All these things that we hear in the meetings is what I was hearing at this facility. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that. And I went back home to Yuma, and in 1986, there was no Narcotics Anonymous. But there was AA. And I don't mind saying AA in a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, because if it weren't for our predecessors, there would be no Narcotics Anonymous. And so I went into this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a bunch of old wrinkly guys. And, you know, looking back, they were probably the age that I am now. Like, I'm 50. I turned 50 this year, right? And they were probably like, but to a 16-year-old girl, they were a bunch of old wrinkly guys, right? And back then, they didn't want to hear from some young drug addict. They didn't want to hear about what I was going through because it was the wrong disease for their meetings, right? And I didn't know yet about meeting etiquette, right? I didn't know about meeting etiquette. Nobody taught me that at my treatment facility. So I went in there. I'm an addict alcoholic, right? If you're sitting in here tonight and you're an addict alcoholic, welcome to Narcotics Anonymous. Keep coming back. You'll get it. One disease, right? We love you too. But, you know, but they would tell me, you know, we don't want to hear about your disease. That's not what we're here for. So it's sit down, shut up, or leave. A 16-year-old girl, I said, okay, I'll just leave. Because I had an attitude. I willingly would go back out into active addiction. And when I turned 18, I caught another charge as an adult for the first time. And thank God, Narcotics Anonymous arrived in Yuma, Arizona. Because my new probation officer told me, I want you to go to these meetings. And the guy that I was with, it was a really abusive relationship, and he was on probation too, because, you know, it's the best place to find guys, right? And and so we were told to go to these meetings, and I found my home. It was a really small fellowship, and we had one meeting a night, and the same, like, 15 people went to every meeting, and I got a sponsor, and I worked steps, and I went to every meeting every night, and I was in a really bad relationship. I got a service commitment, and we didn't have an area secretary, and so all of our meetings were like collecting all their money. And we didn't really have an area at that time. We just went to meetings, and that was it. And so all these meetings were collecting their own money. And in this meeting that I chaired, I had like $300 worth of cash saved up and stashed. And one night I went to get my stuff to go and chair my meeting, and the money was gone. And I had to go to that meeting, and I had to tell you guys, Keith found the money, and he went and bought dope with your money. And I thought that they were going to kick me out of Narcotics Anonymous. And I was so scared, and I was so heartbroken. And it was the hardest thing that I ever had to do, was to go and tell you guys that the money that you gave me to hold and to take care of, somebody bought dope with it. And instead, what you guys did was you gave me a new position in Narcotics Anonymous. And you told me, you know what, we don't have a treasurer right now, and we don't have a secretary. Here, how about you figure it out so that doesn't happen to anybody else? And that's what we do in Narcotics Anonymous, right? We don't let people go. We just give them more responsibility to make them feel part of. And I was really proud of myself, because I figured out a system for our area back then that eventually got our phone line turned on and our bank account in the black. And all the meetings had literature and key tags, and I was super a part of. But I would go home at night, and I would be in this abusive relationship. And this one night, I was at my mom's house doing laundry, and he called me from the bar, and he told me, I'll be home in an hour. You better be there when I get there. And this was at midnight. And I went into my mom's room, and I woke her up, and I told her, Mom, I'm really sorry, but can you please take me home? You know, this is one of those times in my life where I absolutely know that God was taking care of me. My mom never let me borrow her car back then. And that this night, she told me, I'm going to give you my keys, and if you're not here in the morning to take me to work, I'll never let you use my car again. And so I went home that night. And for the next 4 hours, proceeded to be chased around our apartment. At one point, he held a knife to my throat so that I could shoot him up because he was too drunk to do it himself. He had it, threw a hatchet at my head, threw a pan of hot oil at me, was going to cut my hair off, swore if I got out the door, he was going to kill me. At one point, I was able to trip him up and get out the door and get in my mom's car and hit the lock just as he grabbed the handle. And he jumped on the hood of the car and shattered her windshield in one punch. And I was able to get out of there, and I found out 4 days before that I was pregnant with my first child. And so, you know, the crazy thing about, but I know what he's like when he's not loaded. The passion. And then the 6 months that I was with this guy, I left him 3 times and went back every time until this night. And because, you know, it takes near-death experiences to get through to me. And so I went home and to my mom's house, and we called the police and all of that. But anyway, so I was pregnant with my first baby, and I was a high school dropout, and I had nothing to offer this child. And as the pregnancy progressed, one night when a friend was picking me up for a meeting, my mom said very loudly, because my mother is a very tell-it-like-it-is, tough-love mom, and she always has been, and she said very loudly so that I would hear it too, to my friend, "Angie doesn't need this child. She'll use it as an excuse for the rest of her life why she never accomplished anything." And I'll never forget those words. And as angry as I was when I heard them, I had to look myself in the mirror and ask myself, is she telling the truth? And because of the work that I had done in this program up until that point, I absolutely believed that my mom was telling the truth. And so I made the conscious decision to give that child up for adoption and recovery. And I got to tell you that if it weren't for the unconditional love that I learned in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, I wouldn't have been able to be so unselfish and to give that child a better life than what I could have offered her at that time. And so I chose a family that my mom knew. They couldn't have children. They tried for 14 years. I chose this family. I made this mother as much a part of this pregnancy as she possibly could be. I took her to every doctor's appointment with me. She was my Lamaze coach and in the delivery room with me. And when my daughter Amber was born, Dominga said, "Angie, you have a beautiful daughter." And I said, "No, Dominga, you have a beautiful daughter." And the next day when I woke up, Narcotics Anonymous was there for me. You guys were there. You were in the room with me. You were holding my hand while I cried. I kissed my daughter on top of the head the next day, and I put her in her mother's arms. 2 weeks later, I signed the adoption papers, and I moved to San Diego. I moved to San Diego and went with one of the girls that I met in treatment when I was 16 years old. I had my fellowship there. She had a job lined up for me. We had a place to live, and I was getting into life. We would go to meetings, and the disease of addiction started taking hold in my mind and in my heart, and I didn't even realize it, because what I didn't do when I moved to San Diego was I did not get a new sponsor, and I did not work the steps of having just given my child up for adoption, like the hardest thing I've ever done in my entire life. I didn't work any steps on that. So it's no wonder that, I don't know, maybe 6 months, a year later, I was pregnant with my second child, and I was in another relationship. And we got married in Vegas, and, you know, because we were going, so why the hell not, right? And no family was there. And it wasn't too soon after that that we stopped going to meetings because we were doing church, right? And you know what? I'm not knocking church. I go to church today. But if I don't stay grounded in Narcotics Anonymous, like, I've made that mistake once in my life. And the next thing I know, this small little community that we met at church, there's about 7 of us, we moved a small business to Madison, Wisconsin. And in between this time, between having my second child, well, before I actually gave birth to her, we adopted one of my first husband's sister's babies. So now I've got 2 kids, 10 months apart. It was like having twins, really. Moved to Madison, Wisconsin with these 7 people, and they all worked at this little shop, and I was at home, a stay-at-home mom at the age of 21 with 2 small children, and I had a blessed life. At least that's what I thought. Until my husband would come home at night, and he didn't want to hear anything except for dinner was ready, because he had been hearing Roger, Roger, Roger all day at work, right? And late at night when the kids were asleep and the husband was asleep, The walls were thin, and I would start hearing the neighbors next door, what I thought sounded like a good time, and the disease of addiction was taking further root in my heart and in my mind. You know, our symbol talks about the greater the bases we grow in numbers, the broader the sides, the higher the point of freedom. And I forgot about the fact that I had a base. I had forgot about the hope in the rooms. It never even occurred to me that when I went down to that laundry room and started drinking beer with my neighbor that I had just lost 3 years of clean time, because my recovery ended long before my clean time did. So it was no surprise that when I decided one night to write my husband a Dear John letter and jump on an airplane and leave behind two small children to willingly seek active addiction. You know, my friend Nina I over in California talks about she loses her keys, right? And I understand that because I didn't lose my kids either. CPS didn't have to take them away from me. I left them behind. There's a question in our step working guide that asks us about plausible but untrue reasons for our behavior. And my plausible but untrue reason for why I left my kids behind is because they were going to be in a safe place. I wasn't going to be subjecting them to my lifestyle. They were going to be cared for and loved by their father. But after doing some further work in the step working guide, the reality of that situation is I didn't want to be bothered with my kids while I was getting high. They would have gotten in the way, right? So I would go back out for 20 plus years. And the disease of addiction would take me to places I thought I would never go. It would have me in another abusive relationship time and time again. And quite frankly, if I was in a healthy relationship, then I was the abuser. I was the cheater. I was the liar. Another marriage, another pregnancy, only this time every hit was going to be the last hit. Every day was going to be the last day that I got loaded throughout that pregnancy. And then I was giving birth. I managed to not use for a little while after I gave birth because I wanted to nurse. But then one day when the friends were over and my husband was in the bedroom chopping the lines on the dresser, I started crying. And he's like, babe, what's the matter? And I said, I just want to use so bad. And he said, then use. I don't give a shit. He didn't care that I was nursing our son. He didn't. You know, neither one of us cared. That's the disease of addiction. It's insidious. It doesn't care. I just wanted to get high so bad. So I did. And I would walk away from another husband and another child. And eventually I would end up in prison for 5 years. And that whole time that I was in prison, I kept telling myself, I'll never use that shit again. It stole my life. It stole my kids from me. I didn't get a single visit. I watched my kids grow up in pictures. I heard my son's voice change over the phone. And 6 months after walking out of those gates, I was back in the sack. And I was back in an abusive relationship. Well, what was almost an abusive relationship. I was so proud of myself. I remember calling my mom. Mom, I walked away before I got hit this time. And the guy that I got involved with right after that turned into be one of my worst abusers yet. And this one would get me into prostitution. Only I wasn't a prostitute. I was an escort. The disease of addiction had me fooled, right? Girl, you're not out on the street. You're not out on Van Buren. You're not, you know, 50, 20 bucks a pop. You're $300 an hour. Come on now. You live in Northeast Scottsdale. You drive a brand new sports car. You're an escort. It's glamorous. I went down to Yuma one night. I used to love, in the beginning of my recovery, I used to tell the story that I went down to Yuma to see my kid. And what really the true story is that I went down to Yuma one night to bring some friends some dope and just happened to catch my youngest son on the way out of town. And I got hemmed up at our little border check, leaving Yuma, heading back up to Phoenix, that come on vacation, leave on probation border check. And you know, there was absolutely no doubt in my mind that on that day, the God of my understanding was telling me, Angie, it's time for the chaos and the destruction and the pain to stop. I used to like to tell people it wasn't my fault. It was my friend's fault. She had weed. The dogs hit on the weed, right? Or we had my pit bull puppy in the car. The dogs really were barking at my pit bull puppy. And it's not my fault. And after some step work, the responsibility of my side of that street was I wouldn't have got arrested that day if I didn't have meth in my wallet and a loaded gun in the trunk of my car. I got those nice shiny bracelets. I got put in Yuma County Jail, March of 2011. I would get let out of jail. I would go back to using pre-trial, that whole thing. And I knew that when I had to go to court on June 15th of 2011 that I was going to be remanded into custody. So I used as hard as I could on June 14th. And when I went to court on June 15th of 2011, my life changed and started to begin. My clean date is June 15th of 2011. I got put into the drug court program. So if you're here on a court slip, that get well card, man, that thing changed my life. I would go to every meeting I could go to. I would fill up the front of that page. I'd fill up the back of that page. When I would go into court, I would have 3 pages, front and back, filled up. Like, look at how good I'm doing. But do you think for one moment that I was actually trying to do anything good for me, or was I trying to manipulate the situation and impress the court, right? So, from the place that I was staying to the place where our meeting hall is, from point A to point B, this route would take me by my mother's house. And I hadn't spoken to my mom in about 4 years at this point, 4 or 5 years. You see, because my mom found out that I was a prostitute. And my mom proceeded to call my brothers and tell them, your sister's a prostitute. She called my 2 ex-husbands and told them, the mother of your children, she's a prostitute. Well, that's the story that I heard, and that's the way that I perceived it. And so I proceeded to keep this resentment going towards my mother. How dare you tell people I'm a prostitute? I'm a freaking escort. And, But now I know the truth of what she was really doing. She was calling my brothers, my ex-husbands, and telling them that your sister's a prostitute, the mother of your children's a prostitute, and I'm afraid for her life, and I need you to pray for her. But because I held on to this resentment, I didn't speak to my mom in just about five years. And every day that I was driving from point A to point B to get to the meetings, I would drive by my mom's house, and it was a beautiful time of year, and I would see her front door open, and I would hear the God of my understanding knocking on my heart, telling me, Angie, if your children have forgiven you, how dare you not forgive your mother? And if I have forgiven you, how dare you not forgive your mother? And so one night I made a deal with God, and I told him, all right, God, if my mom's door is open tomorrow, because I will wait and do everything tomorrow, then I will stop. And, you know, of course, her door was open the next day, and I almost drove by, and I felt him knock on my heart again. And he's like, nah, you made me a deal. And so I backed up, and you know, there are no coincidences in my life today. And so it was no coincidence that my mom was walking out through her house as I was pulling up in her front yard. And as I pulled up, I was silhouetted. She couldn't see who it was. She didn't know what kind of car I drove anyway. And she walks out the door, and she says, who's out there? And I said, it's me, Mom. And you see, I was expecting the kind of reception that I would give someone who had treated me the way that I treated her, which was very vile. Whenever she would call my condo, my son would answer the phone, and she would hear me in the background just F that B, and I don't want to talk to her, and hang up the, and I was loud about it, and I was rude about it, and I was vile about it. And I expected the kind of reception that I would give someone who treated me that way, get the F off my property. But that's not what my mom did. My mom said, well, get in here. It's about time you came home. You see, because my mom has a very big God, too. And she had been praying for her daughter. And what she had actually started praying for me is, God, I need you to either change her or take her, because I can't take this heartbreak anymore. She was willing to lose me to death than to have to live in fear of wondering whether or not she was going to get that call. When was the day that she was going to get that call? Very soon after that, my mom went out of town, and she asked me to come and stay at her house to watch her dogs. And when she came back from that trip, she invited me to live with her again. And I was going to meetings from her house. And the only problem with living at my mom's house at that time was if I stood on my mom's front porch and I looked one block down the street and across the street, there was a dope man's house. And there's a question here in our step working guide that says, do I think that I can still associate with people connected to my addiction? Can I still go to the places where I used? And I thought that I could. Right? Because I'm a down chick. I can go and I can hang out. And I found myself going and stopping, leaving my mom's house a little bit earlier to go and hang out for a while. And I wouldn't sit in rotation. You know, I was just there to chit-chat and be down and communicate. And, hey, how you doing? I miss you. I love you. You know, when I get off this probation shit, we can, you know, business as usual, and it'll be all great. And then I'd take off and I'd go to the meeting. And when the meeting was over, I would stop back by to say my goodnights before I'd go home. And very soon after that, I was actually sitting in rotation, but I wasn't hitting it. I was helping. So it's no wonder that very shortly after that, I dropped a dirty UA. But I didn't do what they said I did. I didn't deserve to be back in jail, and I sure as hell didn't deserve to be in that rehab that they sent me to. And I was going to tell everybody about it. Man, I told so many people that I didn't deserve to be there that I got tired of hearing it myself. And then one day, this woman walked into the treatment center. And I recognized this woman. I recognized her because we used together about 20 years prior to that. And I proceeded to tell her how I didn't do what they said I did, and I didn't deserve to be there, and hey, why are you here anyway? Well, I'm here to take some of your fellowship members to an outside Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And I'm like, well, how do I get in that car? She said, I'd have to be your sponsor. And I'm like, done, you're my sponsor. Manipulation 101, get me out of this place for an hour. And she took me to that meeting. And she told me, Angie, when we get there, you can socialize, you can smoke, you can get coffee, you can go to the bathroom. But when that meeting starts, I'm just going to ask you to do one thing for me, and I'm going to ask you to sit in your chair and not get up. Because you never know if you might hear something that could save your life. Right? But I wasn't like you people. I didn't use that drug. I didn't use that drug that way. I wasn't homeless. I had a condo. I had a sports car. I had money in bank accounts. I was terminally unique. Our literature says terminal hip and fatal cool, doesn't it? That was me. Terminal hip and fatal cool. I wasn't like you guys. And so then a couple of days later, she showed back up at that treatment facility, and she handed me this basic text, and she said, Angie, I love you so much, and I'm so glad you're here, but you need to read this book. Because I had forgotten about this love story. You know, it was 1986 the last time I'd read this book. I had forgotten about this love story. I had forgotten about the things in here that talks about the way that we feel. It doesn't matter about the things that we have done. I started reading things like, I may not be responsible for my disease, but I am responsible for my recovery. I started reading things like the steps are our solution and using against our will. I started reading things such as surrender means not having to fight anymore. She also gave me a basic instruction that told me that if you think you know the meaning of a word, go ahead and look it up. You might be surprised what that word actually means. So I looked up the word surrender. And by definition, what it means is to go to the winning side. It says stop fighting, admit defeat. Now, I could get behind that because surrender to me always meant being beaten and being broken and please don't hit me anymore. And so when I looked up the word and it said to just stop fighting and to admit defeat, go over to the winning side, right? I could get behind that. In our It Works How and Why, it says this about surrender. It says, we stress the importance of surrender, for it is the very process that enables us to recover. When we surrender, we know in our hearts that we've had enough. We're tired of fighting. A relief comes over us as we finally realize that the struggle is over. Later on in our It Works How and Why, it says this, and this is in step 11. This is what surrender is, a heartfelt belief in our own fallibility as human beings and an equal heartfelt decision to rely on a power greater than our own. Surrender, the stumbling block of our addiction, has become the cornerstone of our recovery. I surrendered that day that I listened to the God of my understanding and I stopped at my mom's house. Today, my mother and I have a beautiful relationship. You know, I never could stand it when my mom would talk to me. Because she would talk at me, right? But that was my perception, right? Will you just please hurry up and shut the hell up so I can get out of here and go get loaded, whatever the case may be. And today my mom and I are able to have conversations because you guys taught me how to be present in the moment. You know, the step work taught me how to be present in the moment. The literature that I read in this fellowship teaches me how to be present in the moment. And I learned how to sit there and be present with my mother and listen to her pain of the things that I caused and to be able to accept those things and take responsibility for them and start the healing process between my mom and I. And today we're able to go on road trips together to Texas and Colorado, trapped in the car with my mom for days. That would have been my perception before, right? But today I look forward to those trips, and we have wonderful times together. You know, we just took one of those trips recently, and we were having such a great time in conversation as we were driving that we were in the middle of BF, New Mexico, when the gas light came on, and I was like, how much gas do we have left? And my mom's car told me 15 miles, and I'm like, oh, okay, let's find the nearest gas station, and it was 6 miles up the road. Now, if that's not God taking care of us, I don't know what is. But because I'm able to actually have conversations with my mom today, you guys taught me how to do that, right? This healing process taught me how to do that. So when I was about 18 months clean, that daughter that I gave up for adoption decided it was time to meet her biological family. And she flew out to Arizona, and she got to meet all of us. She got to meet me because, let me back up a little bit. When I was still in active addiction, Facebook had just arrived on the scene. We were still in that cool one, MySpace. You guys remember MySpace, right? Where you could make your own page and it was all cool with music. And then this dumb shit Facebook came along. But I was sitting at the computer one night about 3 o'clock in the morning and nodding off, of course. You know, I'm like, bitch, get up and go to bed already. But something possessed me this night to throw my daughter's name out in a search engine because she was 18 now, and I knew her name. They let me name her. And I got back about 4 or 5 that couldn't be her because I couldn't remember if there was an S on the end of their last name or not. So then I threw the S on the end of the last name, and I got back about 6 or 7, and the very last one was this little sideways camera phone picture. Brand new Facebook account, 19 years old, San Antonio, Texas, and she looked just like my other daughter. And my son was living, my oldest son was living with me at the time, and I woke him up like a lunatic. And I'm like, I think I found your sister. And so it took me about 3 hours, and I composed this big old long message to her. And, you know, are these your parents? Were you born in Yuma? Yada, yada, yada. And I wouldn't presume to think that you might want to have anything to do with me personally, but you have brothers and sisters who grew up knowing about you, and they would really like the opportunity to get to know you. And I kind of signed it off with, you know, and if you're not my daughter, Amber, like, who is this freaking crazy woman, right? Just ignore this message. But the next afternoon, she wrote me back, and she said, yes, I was born in Yuma. Yes, those are my parents, and yes, you are my mother. And I grew up knowing about you. And I've wondered if I've ever had brothers and sisters. But it wasn't time to meet her yet. Like, the God of my understanding said, not yet. Because I, you know, like I said, I was still in active addiction. And so, but we communicated over the phone and for a few years. And then when I was 18 months clean, she decided it was time to meet her biological family. And she came out and met all of us. And it was a wonderful experience. And so, one of the reasons why I went into the drug court program, I'm just going to jump around a little bit here real quick to set up another part of my story. But one of the reasons why I went into the drug, why I agreed to do that, is because I wanted to manipulate the system to get my youngest son back into my life. Because when I got arrested in 2011, he stopped speaking to me. And I figured if I went through the drug court program like his dad did several years before that, I could manipulate my way back into his life. But it didn't work. This boy decided, nope, that's not going to work. I know your tricks. And he didn't speak to me for the first 3 years of my recovery. But you know what? Something that I learned in that process is that I have to do this thing for me. I can't do it for my kids. I can't do it for my mom. I can't do it for my brothers. I can't do it for my job. I have to do this thing for me. And as long as I'm taking care of me, as long as I'm taking care of my side of the street, as long as I'm clearing up my wreckage, then God is going to make a way for the rest of it to fall into place in his time, not mine. And so I met this guy in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. And I was towards the end of my probation, and I had all these wonderful plans. I was going to get out of Yuma. I was going to move back up to the Scottsdale area. I was going to move with my friend Corey and Diana. I was going to get back into life. I was going to get back out of that town I grew up running away from. And God had other plans. And I met this guy in the rooms in Narcotics Anonymous. And we started dating. And I told him, you know, just so you know, when I get off paper, I'm getting out of here. So don't go falling in love or anything. We can date. And he told me, well, just so you know, I'm going to do everything in my power to get you to stay. You know, it's very ironic that my original topic, I was supposed to be a workshop speaker this weekend, and my topic was going to be talking clean and living dirty. In the first couple of years of my recovery, I was talking clean and living dirty. You see, I already told you guys what I was doing before I got clean. And when after I got clean, I still had a couple of guys on the side that were helping me pay my bills. They would come in from out of town. And one of them even helped me refinance my car so I'd have a lower car payment. And he was my friend. And I told my then dating partner. I wouldn't even admit that he was really my boyfriend at the time. It was weird that I was in a relationship, right? My friend is coming into town and we're going to go to dinner. And he's like, yeah, all right, sure, sure. Well, that evening he called me and he said, I just have one question for you. Yeah, well, what's that? Are we exclusive or what? That's what I did. What? He knows. But I will be forever grateful for him asking me that question, because I decided in that moment that I wanted to be a woman of integrity. I kept hearing about this word integrity in the rooms in Narcotics Anonymous, and I kept hearing about it in our literature and in our step work, and I wanted to be that. You know, there was a point in time that out in active addiction, way back in the day, when my word is my bond, right? Remember that bullshit line in active addiction on the street? My word is my bond. And I wanted my word to be my bond again. And so I went and I met with this man and I told him, I can't do this anymore. I've met somebody. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not watching my clock like I said I would. I've met somebody and I want to be loyal and I want to have integrity. And I walked away from that room that night and I didn't look back. And I was very proud of myself because I walked away from a stack of cash that was like this sitting on the dresser. And I didn't care. And so it wouldn't be very long after that that this guy asked me to marry him on the stage of MACNA at the Saturday night meeting. I totally wanted it to be that night, and he did. It was the best. And you know what, you guys, Narcotics Anonymous showed up for us for our special day. We had like 300 guests there. And it was you guys, and it was our family, and it was our business associates, and you know, I had broken my mother's heart so many times by getting married twice and not inviting her, not even letting her come to help me pick out a wedding dress, because let's face it, I didn't wear a wedding dress the first two times. And my mom got to go help me pick out a wedding dress. And that daughter I gave up for adoption was in our wedding. And that son that didn't speak to me for the first 3 years of my recovery was in our wedding. And his daughter was in our wedding. And our three grandchildren at the time was in our wedding. And I say at the time because we now have 13 grandchildren. I know, right? And the most awesome part about that is not just the number, but the fact that our children allow us to be a part of our grandchildren's lives today. Like, I got invited to be at the birth of one of those grandchildren. And this was the child that I walked away from in Wisconsin and left her behind with a note to her father and didn't see her for years because I was too busy getting loaded to raise my children. And she let me be there for that. So I've been given the 5-minute sign. So real quick, I want to tell the newcomers out there that if you haven't read this love story yet, read it. Because you're going to read things in here like we have never seen a person who lives the Narcotics Anonymous program relapse. And in order for me to know what it means to live the Narcotics Anonymous program, then I have to work the steps of Narcotics Anonymous. And then I have to live by the spiritual principles that I learned in those steps. And if I live by the spiritual principles, that even when I make mistakes, they're not going to be nearly as bad as the ones that I made without them. The wreckage isn't so bad today. Those 8th and 9th steps aren't so detrimental today. Because I'm able to see where I do wrong today and make amends for them quickly. My greatest desire is that I've touched at least one heart tonight. And so if you're that person out there, thank you. I love you. Nakona, thank you very much for having me. One disease, one program, one promise. Say it with me, guys. Promises is that an addict, any addict, can stop using drugs, lose the desire to use, and find a new way of life. Thank you for letting me share.